Luke chapter 20. Luke chapter 20, Jesus is now in the final week of his life prior to the cross. It's very likely that these events are on Tuesday of that week. Now, it happened on one of those days, final days before the cross, that Jesus taught the people in the temple and he preached the gospel. This was his activity on the final week. Having come to Jerusalem, he would go early in the morning to the area of the temple, and he would teach people about the Lord, about the Father, and then preach the gospel to them the way that they might have a relationship with him. And while he was doing this, the chief priests and the scribes, these are Jewish religious leaders, for the most part corrupted at this time in Jewish history, they came together with the elders who were of like ilk, and they confronted him. So this isn't a pleasure visit that they're making. They're going to confront the creator of the heavens and the earth. Think they're up to it? I don't think they're up to it. It's going to be a bad chapter for them. And so they confront him. So they're hostile. And worse than that, they confront him publicly. He is engaged in heavenly activity. And now they are going to confront him in the midst of that. And they spoke to him saying, "Tell us by what authority you are doing these things, or who has... is he who gave you this authority?" And so they're asking him about the authority that he has done these things. What are these things? Recent chapters. Receiving the worship of the people as he made his triumphant entry. Worship that was reserved for the Messiah alone. Psalm 118. And then the cleansing of the temple. Running out of the people that were making money off of people's love for God. And so they come and they said, "Who gave you this authority?" Now it's more than it's no innocent question. It's a trap. It's an attempt to trap God. I don't know how successful you've been at trapping God. Sometimes people try to do it with their prayers, don't they? Get them in the old, in Jesus' name, amen, headlock, and then try to force them. You've done no better than I have, I can tell. But what they're trying to do is trap him. And what they hope that he will say to them is that his authority is from the Father. And that he is the Father's Son. That he will say in Jerusalem what he has been saying all over Israel. So that they can then accuse him of blasphemy by their definition. Bring him to religious trial under that charge, condemn him to death. But they're not in charge of this situation. Heaven is in charge of this situation. The Lord is in charge of the situation. And he's not going to die on that cross, not one moment earlier than was intended from all of man's history and before man's history. So he answered and said to them, "I will also ask you one thing and answer me." In other words, I've got a question for you. You answer my question, then I will answer your question. So he answers their question with a question. That's lawful. Jesus does it, especially when they're dishonest questions. He said, "The baptism of John," that is John the Baptizer, "was it from heaven or from men?" In other words, where did John get his authority? Well, they reasoned among themselves. And they said, "Well, listen, if we say that he had his authority from heaven, then Jesus will say to us, then why didn't you believe him?" Why? Because John the Baptist openly declared Jesus to be the Messiah. "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." That was John the Baptist's testimony. And if John the Baptist ministered under the authority of God, then they ought to have believed John the Baptist's testimony, and not only should they not be harassing Jesus at this moment, though he's up to it, but they ought to be worshiping him and acknowledging him for who he is. So they say, if we answer that, then we're in trouble. related to that. But if we say that his authority was from men, he didn't have any authority from God, all of the people will stone us. That wasn't that delightful of an alternative to them, for they are persuaded that John was a prophet. And the people believed and knew that John was anointed from heaven, that he was a prophet from God. And so here they say, well, we can't say, you know, either way on these things because it doesn't work out well for us. And so they answered that they did not know where John's authority was from. And that's a lie, and it's dishonest. And Jesus said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. And so Jesus refuses to answer their question. It's interesting that in the Gospels, Jesus always answered honest questions, honest hearts seeking revelation from him, illumination, but he did not feel compelled to answer dishonest questions that were intended to trap him. Now, he does something fascinating in this verse 9 because he begins to tell a parable that's known as the parable of the vineyard owner. And what he does here now is he answers their question, though by way of parable. And since he answers it by way of parable, he makes his point to them. They'll recognize what he's saying to them, but not clearly enough to charge him before the Sanhedrin. I'll tell you, don't mess with God on this stuff. He's smarter than us. So then, and the context is this attempt to trap him, he began to tell the people. Now, they have publicly tried to trap Jesus and humiliate him. So Jesus is going to take these guys down a notch or two or 10 or 50 publicly now before the people. So he began to tell the people this parable. He said, there was a certain rich man who planted a vineyard and he leased it to vine dressers and he went into a far country for a long time. Now you read that to a Gentile audience, which this is probably at least 95% Gentile. And to be a Gentile is simply a non-Jew. I'm not saying something bad about you. I mean, that's something extraordinarily bad about you. But they would immediately recognize the use of this image of a vineyard as being most likely, as a parable, a reference to the nation of Israel. Because throughout the Old Testament, especially in Isaiah chapter 5, it was used by God to speak of the nation of Israel. Now, there's a certain man who planted a vineyard. He owned the vineyard. Who called the Jews out from among the peoples of the world to make them a vineyard, to make them a fruitful place in the midst of planet Earth? That's God the Father. The Father. So they would recognize that the certain man was the Father. He's the one that had brought the nation into existence. Now notice that he leased it to the vine dressers. The vine dressers are, of course, these religious leaders that are opposing Jesus. And the word leased is an interesting one because the nation of Israel had been given over by God to the oversight of the religious leaders in order that they might, as a result of their oversight, produce a spiritually fruitful nation. Now remember when Jesus comes and makes his triumphant entry into the city and comes in, there's the fig tree, there's no fruit. The nation is virtually fruitless under the oversight of these religious leaders. And so this vineyard was leased to them. In other words, they were overseers, they were stewards, they were not owners of Israel or of the Jewish people. And that's what God is communicating to them. Jesus is one of the things through this parable. This nation was called into existence by God. It does not belong to you. These people do not belong to you. Why do you fight God for what is His? Why do you harass me this way? Why do you harass Him this way? Why must He compete against you for the supreme role in the life of His people? It's because you've lost sight of the fact that you don't own this nation and you don't own these people. They were given to you as a stewardship to point them to God and make them fruitful. Well, he continues the parable in verse 10 and said, now at vintage time, harvest time, He sent a servant, that is the master, the certain man, to the vine dressers that they might give him some of the fruit from the vineyard. So you have the harvest, and what they would do is the people that were tending the land, oftentimes it would be some kind of agreement, fairly often a 60-40 thing, where those that were tending the land, the vine dressers, would get to keep 60% of the fruit of the land. But the rent for using the land would be about 40% that would go to the owner. So the owner is not doing something extraordinary to these people by asking for the before agreed amount, portion of the harvest for himself. But the vine dressers beat the servant that was sent to them and sent him away empty-handed. And so the certain man sent another servant, and all of these servants represent the prophets of the Old Testament. He really got treated terribly, most often by the religious leaders in the Old Testament. So he sends another servant, and they beat him also, treated him shamefully, sent him away empty-handed. And again he sent a third, and they wounded him also, and they cast him out. And then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do?" He said, "I will send my beloved son. Probably they'll respect him when they see him." And here in verse 13, Jesus answers their question of verse 2, "By what authority do you do these things?" And he is revealing that to them in a way that they understand, but that they can't take to a court of law, that he is the Father's son, and that he is doing what he is doing by the Father's authority. So he sends the son, but when the vine dressers saw the son, they reasoned among themselves, saying, "This is the heir, come let us kill him, that the inheritance may be ours." Now Jesus is exposing them publicly. Again, they would understand what he's doing here. He is exposing the fact that he knows the secret plans that they have made for his death. He's prophesying his death here. And so they cast him out of the vineyard and they killed him. And therefore, what will the owner of the vineyard do to them? Jesus answers the question for them. He will come and destroy those vine dressers, those religious leaders, and give the vineyard to others. And when they heard it, they said, "Certainly not." Jesus said, "All right, you guys win. You're the big grand poobahs. Saw you with your big buffalo hats walking through Jerusalem and everything. Saw you in the Flintstones." So Jesus looked at them when they said, "Certainly not." And he said, "What then is this that is written? The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone." Jesus now quotes from Psalm 118, a passage that was written concerning the Messiah. And he is declaring to the religious leaders that their rejection, far from disproving him as the Messiah, is just further biblical proof that he is the Messiah. Because the psalmist, by the Spirit of God, prophesied that when the Messiah came, that there would be this rejection of the chief cornerstone by the builders, the leaders of the nation. And again, the image now is building rather than agrarian that's being used. So the rejection didn't disprove anything. It simply proved that he was further the Messiah. And then Jesus said, in verse 18, "Whoever falls on that stone will be broken, but on whomever that stone falls, it will grind him to powder." And what he's saying is this: God wins either way. God is going to win in this universe. God is going to win on planet Earth. There is no struggle. God is not, he's not taking any high blood pressure medication. He's not taking nitroglycerin tablets. Nobody is anxious in heaven over how all of this is going to turn out. I've been reading Psalm 37 a lot recently. Talks about when wicked men prosper. Don't get angry. Don't fret over it. Trust in the Lord and do good. I can do that. Trust in the Lord and do good. I need things that simple. But later on in that psalm, it talks about the prosperity of the wicked. And the false conclusions that the wicked come to concerning their longevity or their own importance because of their prosperity, and it tells us what God does in heaven during the prosperity of the wicked. You know what it says he does? He laughs. Well, listen, if he can laugh, I ought to laugh. I need help with that sometimes. But he laughs. And so whether they accept or whether they reject it doesn't matter. God is going to win in all of this. And so whoever falls upon the stone, that is broken in coming to know the Lord. It's speaking of conversion here. When I come to know the Lord, it requires brokenness on my part. I have to confess that I'm a sinner, that I need a Savior, that I'm helpless to save myself in any way. I come to him, but the alternative to that, to myself being broken to come to the Lord, is then to have that same stone fall on me in judgment and grind me to powder. Well, God wins either way, and he longs to bless, but if he's forced to judge, then he will judge. And the chief priests and the scribes, that very hour, they sought to lay hands on him. I mean, you can imagine, these guys are steaming. I love these kinds of people. Steaming. I mean, they are so angry. Nobody talks to them this way, and he has publicly put them in their place. So they're very, very angry. But the reason that they didn't do it is that they feared the people, for they knew that he had spoken this parable against them. So they watched him, and they sent spies who pretended to be righteous, that they might seize on his words in order to deliver him to the power and the authority of the governor. And so they decide to change their tactics rather than coming out openly and demanding, you know, who gave you this authority? Now they're going to work even more deceitfully. They're going to send some of their kind of emissaries to come to Jesus, pretend that they really like what Jesus is saying and what he's about, in an attempt to get him to say something wrong in his words, and then either violate religious law according to the Jews or Roman law, and then have him arrested as a result. And then it's those, you know, dirty Romans arresting him and not them, so they wouldn't have problems with the people. They needed the people to still like them. The people had the money, and religion was a money-making thing in those days, still is. And so they come to him and they asked him, saying, "Teacher, we know that you say and teach rightly." So they come with flattery. And whenever you ever have that sense when somebody is flattering, you're waiting for the but. It was a wonderful sermon. It was fabulous. But, okay, here we go. Of course, but means forget everything that came first. Here comes the hammer. And so they come in and they come with a flattery. Know that you say and you teach rightly. You know, you're not... you're impartial, and you don't show favoritism, but you teach the way of God truly. They didn't believe that, but they knew how to say it. Is it lawful, this is their question that they pose, is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Now, I don't know how many nights they spent up thinking this one up. Tom, you have any idea, anything you've read? Nothing at all, either? You're okay, blank on that? Okay. I didn't know. Tom is a resource for me. You know those guys that are like on the radio and television, so they have these resource guys on the side and everything. Tom does. I don't know if you know that, but Tom does that for me here in the service. Well, here's what they're trying to do. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? They're trying to divide the popular public support of Jesus. If Jesus comes and says, yes, it's lawful to pay taxes to Caesar, then the common people whose expectation of the Messiah was that when he came, that he would lead them to throw off Roman rule, not to support it by taxes, then they would look at Jesus and say, this isn't the Messiah. We have higher expectations of the Messiah than this. And then the crowds that were obviously around him in his teaching would begin to melt away. But if he said, no, it's not lawful to pay taxes to Caesar, then they run down to the principal's office there, the Roman officials, and they say, Jesus said that they're not supposed to pay taxes, and he's creating an insurrection among the people. So if he says yes or he says no, they've got him in a lot of trouble. But the Lord is funny. He, You know, he doesn't feel compelled to answer yes or no to yes or no questions. I guess when you're God, you feel that freedom. And he perceived in verse 23 their craftiness, that they're trying to trap him. It's a trap. So he said to them, "Why do you test me? Show me a denarius," which was a Roman coin. The value was about a day's wage for a laboring man. And then he posed a question to them, "Whose image is and inscription does it have?" And they answered, and they said, "Caesar's." And Jesus said to them, "Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." So he takes the coin, he asks for a coin. "Whose image is on it?" They said, "Caesar's." And he said, "Fine, give to Caesar what has his image on it, but give to God what has God's image on it." What has God's image on it? You and me. Man created in the image of God. And so Jesus is saying, don't be afraid to give your taxes to Rome. And the Bible teaches us that we're to pay taxes. Doesn't mean we can't fight for lower taxes, but we're to pay taxes as Christians. So we're to give the government taxes, but we are never to give anyone but God our life, our heart, our mind, our soul, and our strength. And again, he shows up the religious leaders on this scene because he communicates, in essence, that the greatest issue in life is not taxes and who we pay taxes to. And if we pay taxes, the greatest question in life is, who has my life? Who am I giving my life to? So he elevates the entire thing. They could not catch him in his words in the presence of the people, and they marveled at his answer, and then they kept silent. Listen, when you've been put down, sit down. And they did. I've been put down many times. You accept it. You sit down. And so he got out from around all of that, and not only did he escape the trap that they had set, but he gave great instruction to the multitude in these things. So they come with a second trap, and the whole chapter is all about trying to trap Jesus. And some of the Sadducees, who deny that there is a resurrection, they came to Jesus. Now the Sadducees, they were the rationalists of their day. Anything that they could not understand with their mind, they did not accept. They worship their mind. And a mind is a terrible thing to waste. It is also a terrible thing to worship, because it's self-worship. And so they didn't believe in resurrection because they couldn't understand it. They didn't believe in angels because they never saw one. They didn't believe in this. They didn't believe in that. They only believed the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament, the law, the writings of Moses. They didn't believe in the prophets. They didn't believe in the poetic or the historic books. They didn't believe in these things, the things in there that they didn't understand. So they denied that there was a resurrection, and this group comes to him, and they asked him, they said, "Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies, and he has a wife, he dies, he's married, he leaves the wife behind, and he dies without children, the law of Moses taught that his brother should then take his wife as his wife, raise up offspring for his brother, raise up a son for his brother. The son would then take the brother's name, so the brother's name would not be lost in Israel." It's very important to the Jews that lineage wouldn't die out. And they said, that's what the law of Moses taught. And then they bring a hypothetical situation to him. They said, there were seven brothers. And the first one took a wife, died without children. So the second took her as wife, he died childless. And the third took her, in like manner, the seven also. And they left no children. They all died. Last of all, the woman died also. Yes, indeed. Seven. Can you imagine? Is this an illustration or a nightmare? Therefore, they said, in the resurrection. And they're scorning the idea of the resurrection. Whose wife does she become? Because all seven had her as wife. And so what they're doing is saying, ha, 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 ha. They're making fun of the resurrection. The seven and the whole thing and the resurrection. A stupid idea. And they're snickering with each other. I don't know how long it took them to come up with this whole thing. I remember I have a twin brother. And sometimes at the dinner table, And we had a stepdad that he didn't appreciate this. He'd slug us for it. You laugh now. But you'd sit there, and then all of a sudden, it's a dinner time like any other dinner time. But something just starts to strike you as funny. I mean, it could be the lettuce in the bowl. And then he thinks it's funny, and I think it's funny, and then we're sitting there, and then he thinks that what we're doing isn't that funny, which makes it all the funnier still. So you try to drink milk to hide it, and it comes out of your nostrils, and all of these kinds of things, and then you end up, you know, slugged and sent to your room kind of a thing. This is the whole idea. This is a big joke and ha 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 on the whole thing, and we've got Jesus trapped. Because they knew that Jesus had been teaching all along in his public ministry concerning resurrection. Jesus answered and said to them, "The sons of this age marry and are given in marriage. People in this world, they marry and they're given in marriage. But those who are counted worthy to attain that age, that is heaven, and the resurrection from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage." There's no marriage in heaven. That bums me out. Personally, I have a great marriage. So I know that somehow in that heavenly scene, that whatever we have right now, that what happens up there, and I'll recognize her up there, but that somehow that entire scene is so superior to the marriage relationship that we won't even think twice about it. So there's no marriage on the other side of the veil. And so Jesus tells them that, you know, he corrects them in all of this. Their great trapping question wasn't, they thought they were so smart. He says, this question doesn't come out of being smart, it comes out of ignorance. He says, there is no marriage on the other side of this life. And he said, nor can they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. And this is fascinating because Jesus answers their question by speaking openly about the reality of resurrection. And then he takes in verse 36 and he introduces the angels, which they didn't believe in. So Jesus said, I don't care what you believe in or you don't believe in. This is the way that it is. There is resurrection and there is heaven. So he speaks of makes mention of the angels. Now, Jesus speaks to them and says, now even Moses showed in the burning bush passage, that is Exodus chapter 3, that the dead are raised. Now, probably the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the scribes had this running argument between one another, trying to prove each other's doctrine to the other. And since the Sadducees would only accept instruction from the first five books of the Bible concerning their beliefs, they wouldn't receive correction from any place else. And there's ample, you know, proof for a belief in the resurrection in the prophets and in the poetic books, the Psalms, but they wouldn't budge from their position because they wanted it out of the law of Moses. And so Jesus takes and he brings them back into Exodus, which is where? It's in the law of Moses. And so he said, remember Moses in that passage where he wrote concerning his burning bush experience in Exodus chapter 3, when he called the Lord there, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He didn't call them the God who used to be the God of Abraham, the God who used to be the God of Isaac, the God who used to be the God of Jacob. Why didn't he say that? Because Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were living. Though in Moses' time, they had been dead for hundreds of years. The fact that they had died in this realm, the physical realm, did not mean that they had ceased to exist in the spiritual realm. God was, when Moses spoke to God and God spoke to Moses, God was still in a relationship with the three. Why? Because they were still alive. Why? Because the truth of the resurrection. So he shows them this out of the law, and then he gives them the conclusion from the passage in verse 38 when he said, for he, that is the Lord, is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for all live to him. Now, the Sadducees have now been silenced by Jesus' wisdom. And in verse 39, some of the scribes, these were the guys that copied the scriptures by hand, and they were experts as a result in the scriptures. They answered Jesus and they said, "Teacher, you have spoken well." And they had to be thinking to themselves, "We have been trying to find a verse that would get those guys all those years. We never saw that before. You did it." Now, they're all excited because they think Jesus is on their side now. But after that, the Sadducees, they dared not question him anymore. But Jesus had a question for the scribes. And he said to them, "How can they say that the Christ, that is the Messiah, is David's son, or that is only David's son? David himself said in the book of Psalms, Psalm 110, the Lord," speaking of the Father, "said to my Lord," David is writing this, "the Lord," the Father, "said to my Lord," that second Lord refers to the Messiah, "sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." So here you have David calling the Messiah Lord. You're talking about a patriarchal society where one who is a son or a descendant, or the patriarch, the oldest in a family, would never call a younger in the family, a younger male, Lord. So everyone knew that when the Messiah came, he would be a descendant of David. And Jesus came into the world as a Messiah, as the Messiah, as the scriptures prophesied, through the lineage of David. But Jesus comes on the scene and says, not only am I a descendant of David and the Messiah, but he came on the scene and declared himself to be divine, the Son of God. In other words, he was greater than David. How could you be greater than David as a king in Israel's history, but be divine? And here he takes them to the passage in 110, where in Psalm 110, where David calls the Messiah Lord. What does that mean? It means that Messiah was going to be human flesh, a descendant of David, but in order to fulfill this prophecy, he had to be more than merely a descendant of David. He also had to be divine. The passage brings out the humanity and the divinity of Jesus, that it was required that he be both in order to be the Messiah. And they rejected Jesus continually because he ascribed deity to himself. But this was a passage that they overlooked. So Jesus draws their attention to it. And he said, "David therefore calls him Lord. How is he then his son?" Or how then is the Messiah merely his son? It's got to be more than that. "Then in the hearing of all of the people, he said to his disciples, 'Beware of the scribes, who desire to walk in long robes. They love greetings in the marketplaces, the best seats in the synagogues, and the best places at the feasts.'" He says, listen, don't do this kind of stuff. Don't live like they do. "They devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation." And then he looked up and he saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury there in the area of the temple. And he saw a certain poor widow. I mean, that's hard. A widow was going to be in trouble anyway because she was the lowest in that society, powerless in that society. And she's not only a widow, but this was so often the case, she was poor. And she put into the treasury there in the temple 2 mites, very, very small sum of money. And Jesus said, speaking to his disciples, "Truly I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all of these other people that have been putting into the treasury. Why has she put in more? For all these out of their abundance have put in offerings for God, but she out of her poverty has put in all the livelihood that she had." And so She gave more in the sense of sacrifice. That's how heaven measures what is given to him, not the amount, but the level of sacrifice on the part of the giver. And she gave all the way down into her livelihood. Now, it's fascinating that Jesus, you thought that there would be another verse right there and say, and that woman, I don't know where she's going to eat tonight. But in all of it, there's an ounce of pity on Jesus' part toward her. He knows she's going to be taken care of. He knows that the Lord is never going to allow that kind of person to go hungry or become destitute. And then as some spoke of the temple, the disciples are speaking to him about the temple, how it was adorned with beautiful stones and donations. He said to them, as for these things which you see, the days will come in which not one stone will be left upon another that shall not be thrown down. And so the disciples are there. They have Jesus there in the area of the temple. The temple was absolutely fabulous in its beauty. They're showing Jesus all of the beauty of the temple. Jesus is not impressed with anything in this world, not even the beauty of that temple. And he declares to them that the day is coming in which not one stone of that temple would be left upon another. One of the interesting things is you go to Israel today or get any picture of Israel. From the Temple Mount toward the west, overlook from the Mount of Olives, looking west at the Temple Mount, and when you look at that, you see a dome of a rock mosque. You see no temple on the Temple Mount. It's gone. Fulfillment of Jesus' prophecy here. When Titus came in, a Roman general in 70 AD, and conquered Jerusalem because of their rebellion against the Roman, the Jewish rebellion against Roman rule, that by the time they got done breaking down that rebellion and the temple was set on fire and the gold went down between the cracks of the stones, and the Romans were so furious at their own loss of life, so needless in their mind to conquer these Jews, they knocked one stone off of another to get the gold between the rocks. And then in their fury related to all of these things, they rolled the stones of the temple to the edge of the Temple Mount, and they rolled them over the edge. And you go to Israel today, on the west side of the Temple Mount, they have excavated what was once a long colonnade and walkway right below the Temple Mount area. It was all laid in these gigantic stones, beautiful stone walkway, and they have uncovered the very stones of the temple that have been rolled over the edge of the retaining walls and everything that made up the part of the Temple Mount, and they rolled it over the edge. They broke up the pavement down below, and they stand in a heap as a testimony to the truthfulness of Jesus' prophecy here. And so they're impressed with all of these things, and Jesus said, don't be impressed with that. Better be impressed with my word that'll outlive heaven and earth, but not with this. And they asked him, and they said, teacher, but when will these things be? What will be the sign? What sign will there be when these things are about to take place? Now, we know from Matthew's gospel that they posed an additional question to Jesus in all of this. Matthew's gospel records two questions that give us some insight into what's being asked of him here. And I think in order to give us understanding of how Luke lays the whole thing out, here they've got, teacher, when will these things be? That is the destruction of the temple. And what sign will there be when these things are about to take place? Now, we look at that and we think they're talking completely about the destruction of the temple. But in the Jewish mind, when Jesus spoke about the destruction of the temple was so beautiful, it was so permanent in their mind, that to speak about the destruction of the temple was in their mind to speak at the same time of the end of the world, the destruction of the world. So in essence, they are asking in Luke's gospel what is recorded in Matthew's gospel, and that is, what will be the sign of these things, and what will be the sign of the end of the age? They think they're asking one question about one event. Jesus is going to answer them knowing that they have asked two questions about two very different events. separated by some block of time, 70 AD, the destruction of the temple by Rome, and then we wait for the end of the age yet today for Jesus' second coming. So there's a block of time between. So Jesus begins to answer those two questions, though they have in their mind posed one. And he begins by talking about the characteristics that will constitute the condition of the world in the last days, the end of the age, in verse 8. When he said, take heed that you not be deceived. For many will come in my name, saying, I am he, that is the Messiah. And the time is drawn near, and therefore do not go after them. Of course, when the world gets chaotic, it gets crazy, what happens? Kooky people rise up, and they take advantage of the situation and say, I am the one with the insight, and I'm the religious leader, and so follow me. Jesus said, listen, when it gets crazy, don't go to these people, go to your Bible. But when you hear of wars and commotions, don't be terrified, for these things must come to pass first, but the end will not come immediately. And then he said, nation is going to rise against nation. There's going to be wars, kingdom against kingdom. There's going to be rebellion within kingdoms. And there'll be great earthquakes in various places, famines, pestilences, that is diseases. And there will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. And then in verse 12, he moves from speaking about the end of the age to speaking about the near fulfillment, that is the destruction of Jerusalem, because he introduces it with two words, but before. Now, before the end of the age, this is going to happen. And he's talking about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. But before all these things, they'll lay their hands on you as Christians and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. In other words, there'll be persecution against Christians, and there was, and there is, not only by religious leaders, synagogue people, or whatever kind of religious leaders, but also secular leaders, prisons you'll be put in, and you'll be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. In other words, it's an honor. It's an honor to be so thoroughly identified with his name that they would be able to arrest me for it. But he said, it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. And we saw that this morning, didn't we? So he said, the last three Sundays, the Apostle Paul in there before King Agrippa, what does he do? He believes this promise. The Holy Spirit fills him, and he uses it as an opportunity to share God's truth. He's not intimidated by the scene. He knows the Lord is going to use him for testimony. So Jesus said, therefore, settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer. He's not talking about sermon preparation here. He's talking about being arrested for being a believer and standing before a court as a result of that. For I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. You'll be betrayed even by parents, by family, and brothers, relatives, friends, and they will send some of you to your death. And you'll be hated by all men, by all, for my name's sake. But not a hair of your head will be lost. Now, wait a second. It tells us in verse 16 that some of them are going to die. And then in verse 18, not a hair of your head will be lost. What's he talking about? What he must be talking about is that whatever they do to us on this side of glory, it will not affect in the smallest bit our portion in the eternal realm. Nothing will be less for having been persecuted here. And in your patience, possess your souls. And so an encouragement that when this kind of thing happens to Christians, and happens to Christians all over the world tonight, this kind of persecution happens. He said, in your patience, possess your souls. In other words, don't give up. Don't quit when it gets hard like that. And of course, the Lord gives us the ability to do that. And then he says, when you see Jerusalem, and in verse 20, now you have a passage through verse 24 that has a near fulfillment in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, but also a far fulfillment concerning the end of the age. It wasn't unusual for prophecies in the Old Testament to have a far and a near fulfillment. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. And so, in 70 AD, when those Roman armies surrounded Jerusalem, one of the interesting things, I heard Pastor Chuck teaching on this passage, he said that the Christians recognized what was happening here on this. Some believe that a prophecy came to them as it relates to what was happening, and they escaped out of the city prior to the destruction of the city. And so here is this warning: when you see this happening, then get out. Then let those in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her or come back in. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be a great distress in the land and wrath upon this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So it was fulfilled in a near sense, 70 AD, but this passage we know from Matthew chapter 24 that it also has a far fulfillment when the Antichrist comes in. Scriptures related to that, to run for their life. And it's a mark that things are moving toward the end of the age. Now, both the conquering of Jerusalem in 70 AD and the abomination that causes desolation that will happen midway through the Great Tribulation, the result of that in verse 24 was a great slaughter of the Jews and the return of Jerusalem back under Gentile rule, even as Jesus prophesies here. And then there will be signs in the sun, and Jesus now moves back again to his second coming, which is clear in verse 27. The signs of that second coming, there'll be signs in the sun. Revelation chapter 6 and on speaks about all of these things during the Great Tribulation. And in the moon and in the stars and on the earth, there'll be distress of nations with perplexity. I've always liked that phrase, distress of nations with perplexity. It means problems that when man looks at them, there's no way out. There's no way out. Do you read the newspaper and ever have a sense that man's in just slightly over his head? I have no hope that man is going to solve anything. Because increasingly, all around the world, God is being left out of man's thinking. And so the world is headed. What does the Bible say? Jesus said, listen, if you don't obey my word, it is to build a house on sand. And then when the trouble comes, it all collapses. And what is true of a life is true of the world. The world is building on sand, and there's a shaking coming that they refuse to recognize is coming. And it's all going to collapse. It's all going to collapse. So look for the Lord's return, for the rapture of the church prior to that. But you look at things, and it's all just bluffing right now as I look at it. People think they're so smart, and it's falling apart on every front. But no one will talk about it, and I don't have time to tonight. And so the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them from fear and the expectation of those things. Is that okay, Tom? Okay, thank you. And from those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory, the second coming of Jesus. Now, when these things begin to happen, look up, lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. So he speaks to the disciples and he says, and the key word in verse 28 is begin. Otherwise, you're going to put yourself in the middle of the Great Tribulation. So when you begin to see these things, I think Pastor Chuck Smith has the classic example of all of this. It was given to him, and I wish God would give me a superior one so I wouldn't have to borrow this one all the time. But he talks about, oh, such is my life. But he talks about the time that he went into, at Halloween, into a store in Southern California. And when he went into the store, all he saw all over the place were what? Christmas decorations. Now, when I was a kid, nobody put up Christmas decorations until at least the day after Thanksgiving. That's when America was a great country. But I mean, they just didn't do it. You didn't crowd the holidays. And so he went in there at Halloween, and they already had Christmas things up. And the Christmas, of course, represents the second coming of Christ, and Thanksgiving represents the rapture. And he looked at all of these Christmas things, and he said, look at all these Christmas decorations. It must mean that Thanksgiving is near. And we look at the signs of the second coming of Jesus Christ all around us, and we realize how much nearer, as we see these things begin, the rapture of the church is. And so he declares in verse 29, as he spoke to them a parable, look at the fig tree and all the trees. And when you see they're already budding, you see and know for yourself that summer is now near. So again, the idea is when you see this stuff just starting, you know that the second coming is on its way. It's near. How much more the rapture of the church. And so you likewise, when you see these things happening, know that the kingdom of God is near. And assuredly, I say to you that this generation, probably a reference to the Jews as a people, will by no means pass away until all things are fulfilled. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But take heed to yourself. And now he gives the point for all of us and all of us. Take heed to yourself, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. In other words, don't find yourself in the middle of what God has said is set aside for judgment. Be separated away from it, for it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, and pray. These will be the two characteristics of one who is living differently from the rest of the world. They'll be watching for Jesus's the rapture of the church, and then they'll be praying in the middle of all of this mess. Watch, therefore, and pray always, that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. And of course we will, because of the grace of the Lord, if we've trusted in Him for salvation. And in the daytime He was teaching in the temple, and at night He went out and He stayed on the mountain called Olivet. And then early in the morning all the people came to Him in the temple to hear Him. Would you have headed down there early in the morning? Let me tell you. Listen, if people will get up at 3 and 2 in the morning to get to the job in the Bay Area, you know, kind of thing needs to do. I mean, how early would you get to the temple to hear Him speak? Talk to these religious leaders this way and then speak the truth that He did. But this gives us some insight into the characteristics of His life and how He spent His life in those final days before the cross.